Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 8th of January. This hour of the program, our attention was drawn to public health with the announcement that Dr. Sanjay Gupta, a neurosurgeon, who's best known for his work as a medical correspondent for CNN, has been approached by President-elect Barack Obama's transition team about serving as the next Surgeon General. We started thinking about the role of Surgeon General and the major health issues before the United States. I think it could safely be said that the last Surgeon General who had a major impact on public health was Dr. Everett Koop, who took on the tobacco industry. This hour, we're going to be talking about the issues that you would like the next Surgeon General to take on in this country. Is it food safety? Is it the obesity epidemic? What about AIDS? What about junk food in schools? Our guest this hour is the executive director of the American Public Health Association, which is the oldest, largest, and most diverse organization of public health professionals in the world and has been working to improve public health since 1872. They aim to protect all Americans and their communities from preventable, serious health threats and strive to assure that community-based health promotion and disease prevention activities and preventive health services are universally accessible here in the United States. Joining us this hour, the executive director of the American Health Association, Dr. Georges Benjamin. He has been a leader and practitioner and administrator in the world of public health for quite some time. He came to his current position as secretary of the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, which is another area that we'll be talking about. He serves as the publisher of the nonprofit monthly publication, The Nation's Health, and the association's official newsletter and the American Journal of Public Health. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Dr. Benjamin. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. For you to join our conversation. Dr. Benjamin, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, good morning.
Nice to have you with us. What do you think about the possible news, which may be confirmed, I guess he's mulling it over, of Dr. Sanjay Gupta to be the Surgeon General? Are you enthusiastic about that possibility?
Well, he's a very interesting choice, and he is an interesting choice because in many people's minds, he's an extraordinary communicator, and some people think already the nation's one of the nation's top doctors. So he, you know, part of the Surgeon General's job is communicating to the American people the science and the facts around health. And so, you know, he's a very, very interesting choice.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he'll say yes?
You know, I don't know. you never know. And these leaks occur for a variety of reasons,
right?
Some to test the waters. Sometimes they're just leaks. We've seen these kinds of leaks before who haven't panned out, but you never know. You just never know.
Mm-hmm. When I think of important Surgeon Generals in the past, the name who comes to mind certainly is Dr. Everett Koop, who took on the tobacco industry. Should the Surgeon General take on a major issue or major issues and really work on them hard and have the name Surgeon General associated with obesity or food safety or whatever? Do we need a high-profile position here?
Well, absolutely. I mean, preserving our health is very important. Without your health, you can't work. Without your health, you can't go to school.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important. And, you know, certainly our most famous Surgeon General is my good buddy Chick Koop. We've had Surgeon Generals that have been enormously successful and effective. From the first Surgeon General who promoted dealing with the problem of tobacco, Dr. David Satcher, who really promoted mental health, and even Dr. Cremona, who was out promoting health disparities and health literacy.
Mm-hmm.
So the Surgeon General has been a very, very important spokesperson for the health of Americans.
Of all the issues that we're looking at now, Dr. Benjamin, which one really requires a huge national focus? Is it obesity or is it something else?
Well, health reform is going to be probably the big issue. But I think the real component of this that doesn't get noticed as much, in which the Surgeon General can play a major role, is not health care reform, because I think we ought to take the care piece out, but talk about health reform. I mean, transforming our health system so that we're really promoting wellness and not fixing things on the other end. And to that, the Surgeon General can play a major role, because that deals with eating better, exercising, dealing with the obesity crisis, dealing with chronic diseases. It means doing the right things to mitigate the risk of people getting sick from an infectious disease outbreak or in food safety. It's a much bigger picture than simply moving the boxes around and trying to do our health system a little differently.
Where do you think we have been successful, Dr. Benjamin, in promoting wellness? What habits have we changed because of national action?
Tobacco is a major, major win in many ways. We haven't won the war completely, as they say, or the battle. But, you know, there was a time in which smoking was culturally acceptable. It was promoted as being healthy and good for you. In fact, the first Surgeon General's group that got together to look at tobacco, many of the people in that room, including the Surgeon General, smoked.
Right.
So we've made a major cultural change. I mean, the days in which someone smoking around you is acceptable, those are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to other countries where tobacco is still a prominent open addiction. People from the U.S. find it intolerable. You go in the restaurants overseas, and there's people smoking in the restaurant.
Right.
We don't accept that as a norm here in the United States. So that's the biggest win I think we've had.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about prevention and promoting wellness, are you talking about building that into the infrastructure in a more substantial way in America? Or are you talking about public service announcements on television or radio? What direction are we going here?
I think building it in so it's a matter of practice and in a much more substantial way. So let's talk about some of the global things. Building our communities different so they're walkable, bikeable, and green.
Mm-hmm.
Paying attention by ways of policies, procedures, the way we do things so that our air is cleaner and our water is safer to drink. Talking about making our communities so it's safe to go out and play basketball at night, so that there are some communities where you can't walk. We have some communities where we still don't have grocery stores, so you can buy fresh fruits and vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
Those are major changes in many communities that we need to promote. Now, it also means that, you know, folks like me, I mean, I don't eat the right foods and I don't exercise as much as I should by any means. But making that a much more the norm for everybody. And we have people that are runners, and yes, we have people that eat better, and we have nutritionists that help us with all that. But it still isn't the norm. We still have too many vending machines in schools where kids don't have healthy food choices. We still have too much salt in our food. We still have restaurants that and fast food outlets for which there really are not a lot of healthy choices. I'm not trying to, you know, be the food police by any means, but I am trying to say that we need to create an environment where we have many, many more healthy choices.
Mm-hmm. It is pretty amazing. This is one of the every now and then you do a talk show and something stands in your mind because it's so enormous. And one of them was, I think, maybe a couple of years ago, we started hearing from the health community that the young generation growing up now may be the first to not live as long as their parents live. Isn't that dramatic?
That's a dramatic change. And and from a chronic disease, obesity and all the negative soliloquy that come from that, all the things that, heart disease, kidney disease, strokes, all the things that happen because of complications, the huge increase potentially in diabetes. We're seeing many, many more people with diabetes, particularly even kids.
Right.
It's a real problem. But we can reverse it. We watched it happen. It's not going to happen overnight. I mean, we watched the numbers. We saw the numbers change. But we can make a dent in that. And there are some efforts to do that. But we can do more.
Mm-hmm. Is it the role of the Surgeon General, Dr. Benjamin, to take on what has become a larger and larger problem with each passing year, and that's food safety and the food that we're getting from countries like China that has been tainted and made people sick?
Well, I think the Surgeon General will pick the things that he or she wants to really focus on. But it's important to know that, that there's certainly an opportunity for the Surgeon General to talk about that, should they choose, from the bully pulpit. But there's a range of other partners in there. We need to make sure that we don't put everything on the world on the shoulders of the Surgeon General. There is the individual who runs the Food and Drug Administration. So the FDA has to do what it needs to do. We have the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. They need to do what they need to do. So this needs to be done as a coordinated collective if we're very serious about improving the wellness and health of Americans and dealing with things like foodborne outbreaks and food safety.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a huge regulatory piece in which the Surgeon General really doesn't have a big role that has to happen at the FDA and a response effort between the FDA and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And I need to add that none of that works without strong state and local health departments.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the folks that are in your community that actually do all the work, that actually go in when you have a foodborne outbreak, and they, the ones that go in and do the restaurant inspections and make sure that the food is safe to eat in the first place.
Right. Not that either of us were around in these days, but I'm interested in the history of your organization. Do you have any idea what the American Public Health Association was dealing with back in 1872?
It was a sanitary movement in our country. And so making sure that people had safe water, that we dealt with things like sewers, and we dealt with our sewage, and educating people about where to throw their trash, and dealing with things like rats and rodents and other vermin were big issues back then. And it involved a collection of people, including physicians, nurses, sanitarians, lawyers. And our earliest founders were a collection of those kinds of people who recognized that you can make a lot of progress by cleaning up the environment and making sure that people understand things like washing their hands.
We have a full line of phones, people wanting to talk to you, so we'll go to phones here in just one moment. We're speaking with the Executive Director of the American Public Health Association, the oldest, largest, and most diverse organization of public health professionals in the world. Our guest is Dr. Georges Benjamin, Executive Director of the Association. Our phone number, try in a few minutes, the lines are pretty busy right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls. Oh, I should tell you about next hour first. This was as a result of our open line when two of you suggested an article, and it's a very interesting article in the January-February issue of Mother Jones Magazine. It's fiscal therapy, and it talks about ways that we can save a lot of money and a lot of breaks that are given to people who are very rich and perhaps don't deserve the breaks as much as people who are not very rich. Phone calls now, 800-486-8655. Julia from Fond du Lac is our first caller. Good morning, Julia.
Yes, hi, good morning. I have a comment, and then I'll take the response off the air, but my comment is about childhood obesity and the role of the schools. And perhaps when we look at the media, it's very easy to see how schools have been blamed for almost everything in terms of childhood obesity. And my comment is that research shows that we need to take a closer look at the positive efforts that schools have been making, especially in these troubled economic times, and also especially working with very low school budgets. And so I would encourage community groups and school districts and parent groups to take a closer look at how we can all be part of the solution as opposed to just pointing the finger to schools and blaming it all on schools.
And what are the solutions that you see that are beneficial?
Well, one of the things is looking at the whole school environment. It's very hard for the school food service department to try to solve all of the nutritional dilemmas that revolve around childhood obesity. There's got to be a tie-in between nutrition education in schools, physical activity in schools, and research shows that more and more schools are very preoccupied with loss of instruction. instructional time and are cutting down on recess, are cutting down on physical activity. So I think we need to look at the whole school district environment, which also tie-ins to looking at the whole community environment. So perhaps, you know, raising awareness about wellness education, about health education, and how we can all be part of the solution as opposed to picking out different entities and then placing the blame on particular entities.
Dr. Benjamin.
Yeah, I agree. We shouldn't put the blame on schools, and I certainly don't mean to do that. But kids spend 6 to 8 hours there. And so from my perspective, you know, go where the kids are. And that's just one place. They also go to daycare. They're also in their parents. And obviously the parents are the first teachers and ultimately are responsible for their kids and what happens. But if they're going to eat there, and they usually eat 1 to 2 meals at school, then don't we have an obligation to make sure that what we serve them does not make the problem worse and certainly is healthy and nutritious? I would agree that in many schools, the budgets that we have to serve to feed kids is not adequate. And my organization pushes very hard to try to improve those budgets, to try to make sure that those kids have the dollars that they need, that the teachers and the food workers have the dollars that they need to feed the kids adequately. And we do that through standards, by pushing for national standards to make sure that the foods are more nutritious. The second thing, though, of course, is I also agree that, yeah, kids need to have more physical activity at school. And we as a culture, you know, have designed an environment in which we're not as physically active. So you get up in the morning and you ride everywhere, and then you go to school and you sit all day.
Right.
And then you ride back home, and then you sit in front of the TV or in front of a video game, and you play all day. And then we wonder why there's an imbalance between what we eat and what we burn up in terms of our activity. So how do you fix that? Well, you build communities so kids can walk to school like they used to, which are safe, walkable, bikeable, et cetera. You make sure that the foods that they're served at school are healthy and nutritious and promote wellness. Doesn't mean the kids can't have hot dogs and tater tots every now and then, but that should not be the bulk of their menu. Also that, again, they can walk back. And whether that's in school or daycare or preschool or whatever, you set the environment for there to be successful. And then I grew up in an era where we had recess several times a week. And I know there's just more and more demand for academic time in the schools. But, you know, if you're not healthy and you're not well-fed, I don't care how many more classes you have, you're not going to learn anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at some point, you max out because you're tired, you haven't either had enough sleep, you're not well-fed, you're not physically invigorated. So taking some time out to let these kids get more physically invigorated and then putting them back in the classroom, a lot of evidence that shows that it improves their ability to learn. So I think those are some things. So I think there's a balance. I think she's right. I think that we need to step back and look so we have a more balanced approach to these kids and also teach them more about health in school.
Right. And it seems to me, just from watching our family grow up, that there are programs for elementary school students, and for some reason, Dr. Benjamin, they seem to end, and maybe it's the pressure of testing and to make sure that there's more emphasis on English and science, et cetera, but they seem to end when it comes to middle school. There is a little bit of PE instruction, but not very much, and you don't have to take PE in high school. I keep thinking that maybe that physical fitness education program that was around, what was that called, back in the Kennedy era, maybe we ought to resurrect it.
Well, that's certainly an option. I'm not going to pretend to be an educator, but I've raised two kids, and I have the benefit of being a kid myself, and I know the pressures on trying to get this information, and I also understand the need for accountability and the demand for accountability, and absolutely want people to be accountable, but it's got to make some sense. You know, I used to talk about trying to build a healthy environment for kids to learn, and the schools are struggling. There's no question about that, which does mean they're going to need more resources.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Thanks very much, Julia, for your call. Let's go to our next caller is Susan from Appleton. Hello, Susan.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me here. Dr. Benjamin had talked about safe water, and one of my big concerns, and nobody seems to want to address it, is the fluoride in the water. Fluoride is a number one health, is a hazardous waste, and it's one of the number one ingredients in industrial rat poison because it just chews up the nervous system, the digestive system. If you ever saw an animal die on it, it's disgusting. It also goes after our nervous system and dumbs us down, and there's just a ton of studies, and I know, I believe it was California has taken it out of their water. It chews up our piping system for the water system, and yet we're being given to it every day. I mean, this is a big health concern here. I mean, we're giving it poison every day, and it's not, you just need a little, and, you know, with the water, anything you cook in it, this, you know, you take a bath in it, anything you drink, you know, the soda, the orange juice, whatever. So we're getting actually overdosed with fluoride, and I think this is a big, big concern. And I'll take my comment off the air.
All right. Do you share that concern?
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. I think that the fluoride used and the levels in which we use and to fluorinate the public water supply, which we do fundamentally to reduce tooth decay, is helpful. Tooth decay and cavities is a major public health problem. There are still many kids who go around not having had their teeth taken care of, and fluorination of water is a great preventive effort. I know there are people who disagree, and you know, we kind of respectfully hear them and understand their perspectives, but I don't agree with their perspective.
Let's go back to the issue that you mentioned a little bit earlier, Dr. Benjamin, and that's it's not just a few. There are a lot of neighborhoods in this country, be they rural neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods, and some suburban neighborhoods, I'm sure, too, where you don't have access. Maybe you don't have a car, you're relying on public transportation, and you don't have access to fruits and vegetables, and the food that you do have access to costs a lot more because of where it happens to be located. What can a Surgeon General or this country do about, and then it goes on to a broader disparity in health services, too, between those who have and those who have not in this country. How do we address that?
Well, I think the first thing is awareness and recognizing that it is a problem, and that as many times as all of us go around and talk about people eating nutritiously and obtaining fresh fruits and vegetables, we then need to follow that up with action. We then need to ask the fundamental question, do you have access to fresh fruits and vegetables? And then do some things about it. So what can you do? Well, you can certainly, and this is usually done at the local level, but you can incentivize communities just like you incentivize other small businesses to bring grocery stores into those communities. You can work with the Grocers Association to enhance the products that are brought into those communities. Governments can use a range of incentives from tax credits and other types of tax breaks, or other resources, capital dollars, et cetera, to help build and promote grocery stores in those communities. They can also go in and they can help convert in communities that have an overabundance of liquor stores and maybe the small convenience stores that may have an oversupply of you know, potato chips and those kinds of things, and find ways to help them put into those communities fresh fruits and vegetables. Because a lot of times they're very expensive, particularly when you're not buying in bulk like the large grocery stores.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be done. But it's going to require innovative solutions by the community to make sure that those things are available. But the first part of this is awareness. The nation's capital, in Southeast Washington, D.C., one of the least affluent parts of this region, until fairly recently, we hadn't had a grocery store in that area in a long time. Now, why is that important? Well, if you're low income, then you've got to sometimes get into 2-3 different buses to get to the grocery store, and then you got to get home with all your groceries. So what are you going to do? You're going to go to the place that's closest to you.
Sure.
and pay more mm-hmm. and get less.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you say it's something we can do, government can do something about it, communities can, do you have any indication that they are?
Yeah, there are many efforts. When people have been made aware of this, in Washington, D.C. is an example where recognizing that there's not been a store there, the community began demanding it, worked with the mayor's office, and eventually a grocery store was put into that community. We're seeing communities that are developing farmers markets. Department of Agriculture can promote this by promoting farmers markets and trying to get local farmers, particularly those of you who live in farm communities, to bring your products locally to the urban setting and sell them. You get your food closer to where it's grown, it's fresher, and those of you who live in farming communities know exactly what I mean. You know, you have great products, and your ability to get them to these communities because of the proximity that you have to some of these urban centers is enormous. And you're not trucking this stuff all the way across country,
right.
You're not buying the frozen stuff. So, yes, it can be done.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to phone calls. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. And we go to Karen from Platteville. Hi, Karen.
Hi, this is Karen. And I'd like to quote Paul Krugman, the recent winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, or not Peace Prize, but, you know, Economic Prize.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that Gupta fudged the facts. That is, Gupta said that Michael Moore fudged the facts. He accused Michael Moore of lying. And, Gupta, does he have enough? All he did was apologize for misreading and not for his comments about Michael Moore. Does he have the capacity to take criticism and then look at a situation in a new way? I have real concerns about his capacity for evaluating things.
Well, thank you. You know, I like everybody else in America, saw the little disagreement that they had, and I've learned very much to not get in the middle of other people's fights. I think that one of the things we're going to have to do, should he be nominated, and remind everyone, he's not been formally nominated, but should he be nominated, should he accept, I think we should measure the man on the totality of what's presented around his academic record, his medical record, his capacity to be a spokesperson, and his capacity to be the head of the Commission Corps. None of us are perfect, and I think that's the way we should judge him. We should use an evidence-based approach in terms of doing that. And if I was being measured, that's what I hope people will do. I have not been perfect. I've been on radio and I've been on TV, and I've made mistakes. And whether Mike forgives him or he forgives Mike, I think at the end of that spat, they kind of agreed to disagree. I know that both of them were using data from a variety of sources and a variety of dates, which always would get you in trouble when you're using a variety of sources and a variety of dates. And all of us have had that problem. Not my fight. So at least that piece of it, I'm waiting. I'm going to wait like everybody else to kind of see the totality of what gets presented about him before we cast judgment.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Karen, for your call. We go to Amy next from Racine. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I don't know. I'm going to speak as clearly and loudly as I can.
Where are you, Amy?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Where are you?
I'm in Racine.
Okay.
One big problem, I think, is dental. The fluoride in the water is not making any difference to a lot of people who have Medicaid. It's amazing how difficult it is to find a dentist who will take Medicaid. We don't seem to have that kind of difficulty with other physicians.
Right.
So that's a really major issue. The other thing is that bad food, like he mentioned, bad food is cheaper. It's much more cheaper to buy a bag of potato chips than it is to buy an apple. And when our economy, well, in the early times of our difficult economy, milk shot way up. The basic important foods shot way up, and the prices of the really, you know, non-nutritious things weren't that much more expensive. So I think that if we can make the food that we need to be, stay healthy less expensive and the other more expensive, that could make a difference. Money talks.
Thank you, Amy, for your call. Dr. Benjamin.
Yeah, she's absolutely right that one of the central, the real challenges we have is reimbursement rates, and dental is the one that's most obvious. We actually had a young man in my region here who died of a brain abscess caused by a dental problem.
Oh,
as a kid, because of lack of access to dentists, and then some concerns about whether he was eligible for Medicaid or not. But even when you have Medicaid, yes, it's a problem. I can also tell you that when I was a health officer in the state of Maryland, we had problems finding pediatric surgeons, orthopedists, specifically for kids. So if you broke your arm on the eastern shore of Maryland, it was very difficult to get someone to fix it who was a pediatric orthopedic specialist. So reimbursement rates in the Medicaid program got to get fixed, and there's no question about it. They're in most places they're not adequate enough to entice providers to see those patients, and that's an ongoing problem. And she's absolutely right about that.
Mm-hmm. And the other problem is access to mental health care. Don't you think?
Mental health remains a problem. The good news is we now have technically meet a mental health parity because that law was passed, but now we're in implementation phase of that and making sure that people actually get the mental health services that they need, and that it's never going to be fast enough for me because I've thought for years this was a very, very serious problem, and it's just horrible. Substance abuse treatment. Having enough places for people with substance abuse remains another problem. And why do I say that as well? Well, a lot of people have a dual problem with both mental illness, particularly the chronically mentally ill, have both a substance abuse and a mental health problem combined. And many of them on top of that also have a tobacco addiction. So we really have a lot of work to do in terms of trying to transform our health system.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Dr. Georges Benjamin. He's executive director of the American Public Health Association, with talk this week centering, one of the talks this week centering on the next Surgeon General. We thought it would be interesting to look at what the health issues are now that deserve intense national scrutiny and action. So we're welcoming your phone calls on the Ideas Network, and our number again is 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, it will be an extremely interesting conversation. The recent article in the January-February Mother Jones magazine, Physical Therapy. The author of that is also a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Back to phone calls now for Dr. Georges Benjamin, who is executive director of the American Public Health Association. And we go to Jeffrey from Kenosha next. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi. Say, I think wellness, I really like talking about wellness. I think that really should be the next big topic for the Surgeon General. And I think people should know, you know, what's enough and what's right. And I think nutritional microscopy, actually looking at the quality of your blood, is what should be stressed. There's a lot you can learn when you look at your blood and it's 25,000 types magnified. So I would like the next Surgeon General to really stress what lifestyle choices we make, how we eat, how we live, how we think, you know, how we exercise, how we breathe, all these simple things. And people can understand, you know, what they're doing when they look at their blood.
Dr. Benjamin.
Yeah, I can't comment on the proposal of looking at the blood. I'm not real familiar with that. But let me tell you that the concept of doing the simple things first and not running a bunch of tests and doing the things that we know promote health, and we know a lot about what promoting health does and what it is, certainly is a better approach than to treating than on the other side. We're learning more and more about the effects of good diet and exercise, et cetera. Nutritionists have been telling this stuff for years.
Sure.
Our solution to everything should not be a pill, by any means. And we need the pills when we need them, but that should not be our solution to everything. And I think he's right in many ways, that you've got to promote the other things. And the Surgeon General can do that. There's no question. But it means that everybody has to. It means that health plans, you know, the health insurance companies have got to promote it. The doctors have got to promote it. You know, you got to go down. When you go down the street and you talk to Auntie Sue or Uncle Joe about your health, which is where a lot of us get our health information, then they've got to be giving you the good information that's correct. When you go to the barbershop or the beauty shop, get a lot of people get a lot of their information in those places. They have to be well informed, so they're giving good information on health and wellness.
Mm-hmm.
And so reaching out to the folks that are the surrogate health educators in the community is going to be very important. And the Surgeon General can serve as a vetted, trusted source to put the information out. But you're also going to need other surrogates for the Surgeon General to do that. But that person, he or she, the Surgeon General, can be the most visible spokesperson for health in our nation.
Thanks very much for the call, Jeffrey. Let's go to Jean from Ashland. Hello, Jean.
Hello. For the past over 20 years, I was purchasing the Control of Communicable Diseases Manual, known as the CCDM for short, through my local bookstore. Just by ordering it, they had it in their warehouses they were buying from. But the last time, and it comes out every 5 years as the official report of the American Public Health Association, but the last time, which would have been the year 2005, the bookstore said, oh, they no longer stocked it. They didn't know how to get it. And I was quite dismayed because I think every household should have a copy. Is it available for purchase directly from the American Public Health Association?
Yeah, actually it is. If I can promote our own book.
Sure, go right
ahead.
It
is the Control Communicable Disease Manual. It is a book on infectious diseases and infectious disease prevention, and you can go to our website at www.apha.org. And you can get it through our website. And I think even Amazon and Zoomerang may very well carry it as well. But obviously, if you buy it directly from us, we get a bigger cut of the sale. But it is a good book. People should look and make sure it is the book that they need for them. If you go to the bookstore if you can, or go to a library and make sure it's the book that you really want.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
It is highly technical.
Thanks, Gene, for the call. Ruby is next from Minnesota. Hi, Ruby.
Good morning. I'm just wondering if you have any ideas on how we can get the government to give surplus and school, foods that they offer the school for free or low cost, if they could be of a better quality, because they seem to be high sodium, high fat, high sugar, and I think that would seem like it would really help schools out. Thanks.
Well, you know, I've always encouraged citizens to be involved in the process of governance. So every community has a school board. Let your school board know. Write a letter to the school board. Write a letter to your principal of your child's school. Let your local health department know by writing a letter to the local health officer or If there are forums and opportunities to where they're going to talk about these things, certainly attend. Show up at the budget hearings for your school board and your local health department, and give them your opinion and your thoughts on all of these issues. Write your governor. It's very going to be very, very important. Department of Agriculture at the federal level has have budget hearings, so you can write your elected officials, your senators and your congressmen and women, and let them know how you feel about these issues. They respond. When they see me coming, they understand that I'm coming to them as an advocate for a national association. And while they listen to me and that hopefully respect what I say, I am not as powerful as five of you in a community going in and seeing that elected official and saying, this is what we want in our community. So all politics is local. All resource allocations are really local. So you have the power to make that kind of stuff happen.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ruby, for your call. Kristen is next from Lac du Flambeau. Hi, Kristen.
Good morning, and good morning to your guests as well. I'm working in Lac du Flambeau at one of the nation's 12 tribal epidemiology centers. Mm. And we have one of our concerns, and wondering what your guests would think about how we can best help the new Surgeon General, whoever that might be, approach the issue of health inequity. I think besides a human rights issue, it certainly does impact our overall economy, which is an issue right now. And to give you just a brief example, it's been well publicized that the nation's cancer rates for all populations have been going down. We've been doing a good job, but not for our Native American citizens. So I would really like to know how we can best assist this new Surgeon General to address health equity.
I think by helping us make sure that health equity is addressed in everything that we do, continuing to raise it as an issue. I would write the members of Congress and tell them that you think that's an important issue, your particular members of Congress, and so that question gets asked at confirmation hearings, at budget hearings, and those kinds of things to make sure it remains on the national stage. I think that as this administration has asked us to give them their advice, and they're going into communities and asking advice. If you go to the change.gov website for President-elect Obama, Secretary nominee Daschle is asking people for their input. So I would encourage you to go to their website and tell them you think this is an important issue that needs to be addressed. I can tell you it's one of APHA's and my organization's overarching priorities is helping to eliminate health disparities, not reduce it, not bring it down a little bit, eliminate it. Mm-hmm. And dealing with Native American health as one of the statistics that we're concerned about. So we would certainly support your efforts, mm-hmm, and doing things that we can at the national level to make that happen.
I know that Daschle's been having listening sessions. Maybe there's a way through your senator here in Wisconsin, Kristen, to get people from the administration to Lac du Flambeau, to one of the reservations, and talk about this issue. I would think that they might say yes, don't you? She's gone.
I do, absolutely. I think that they would, I'm sure they're going to want to know what's going on in the Native American community.
Sure, right.
No question about that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Kristen, for the call. Barb is next from Hazelhurst. Hi, Barb.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
I'm good. One of my major concerns was when my kids were in high school and they were coming from the middle school going into the high school, they weren't the most coordinated kids in the whole wide world, but they still enjoyed doing team sports or whatever, but they, because they weren't like the best in the class or whatever, and they needed to keep their grade point average up in order to obtain scholarships and whatever, they had to non-participate in any of the Phi Ed classes. So, In order to keep their grade point average and still take the classes, they were given, like, golf appreciation papers to do and all this writing and computer stuff. Well, what does that do for the kids' health? and it was so irritating, and I would go to the school board and I would say, can't you just give them a pass-fail? I mean, what's the difference if that ball goes in the hoop or if the ball goes to the side, as long as they run up to the hoop and throw it?
I'm with you.
It irritated me, and they just would not give a pass-fail grade. Mm. It had to be a grade point average, mm-hmm, so my kids took you know, all the appreciation on paper.
Right.
It doesn't make sense to me.
No, it doesn't make sense to me either. How about you, Dr. Benjamin?
Yeah, I'm not an educator, but, you know, there's some things that just don't sound right. And if they don't sound right, it's not our policy. And I just think that it doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
I don't know the rules. I don't know why they did it that way. Maybe they have a good reason, but they probably need to explain it so we could understand it.
Yeah, and there could always be a problem with you may not appreciate golf, right? So what are you going to do?
Yeah.
All right, Barb, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Marion from Richland Center. Hi, Marion.
Here I am again. I'm very concerned about senior care, prescription drug for the elderly, you know. I got a letter from Governor Doyle, and he told me how much taxes it saves the federal government and Wisconsin by having senior care compared to Bush's Part D. I'm an officer in AARP here in Richland County, and I go around and talking to the elderly, and so many cannot afford Part D. And some of them told me if they didn't have senior care, they couldn't take all their drugs. They could take what they could afford, which would be maybe one, and they couldn't take them all, so they weren't going to take any of them. And they could finally buy some fruit that they can't buy now because before they were on senior care, you know. And so I was wondering, all the states are in trouble financially, so I hear. I was wondering why senior care isn't in all the states and save all the states federal money and state money.
Well, the answer is I don't know. But let me start by congratulating you for your work for AARP, a very important organization, very much concerned about the needs of seniors. We're going to have to, obviously, as a nation, take another look at a range of services for seniors. Obviously, us baby boomers are going to get older, so we're going to have this huge bolus of people going through the system. We have a range of needs, from pharmaceutical drugs to support services to trying to age gracefully in our homes with a good quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And not only do we have to figure out how to have these services in the community, but, more importantly, how are we going to pay for it? And because it is going to get costly. There are certainly opportunities that I think we will have. I'm increasingly hearing about seniors who are having trouble paying their bills. Under the Part D program, the donut hole, where seniors at some point reach a cap where the program no longer pays for their prescription drugs. They have to pay out of pocket till they get to another point, and then the program kicks in again. For those not familiar with that, in some places the cost of co-payments, et cetera, are exceeding some seniors' budgets. And it's going to require a look as we go through this health care reform effort. Another look as we go through the effort.
Thanks very much for your call. And let's talk about this effort. Not that it necessarily is in the purview of the Surgeon General, but this whole change, do you anticipate that we are going to be able to take on these huge issues? A, the number of people who don't have insurance, which is sinful in this country, the number of people who are paying, businesses are suffering, individuals are suffering, co-payments, things aren't covered, et cetera. Do you anticipate in the new administration major changes, a major health reform, Dr. Benjamin?
If we don't do it, it will be done to us.
Mm.
I point out the fact that we have several models in front of us, recent experiences. We have an automobile industry which didn't adjust to change, and now we're having to pay for that. If you think you had a problem with a banking system, if you think you had problems with the automobile industry, what do you think we're going to have happen if the healthcare industry crashes? So I think we got to pay a lot of attention to it now before it does it to us. And then we're dealing with people who are at risk of dying or not having any kind of care because the whole system has collapsed. You know, we have if a hospital, in many communities, the hospital is the major employer in town.
Mm-hmm.
And if that hospital can't make ends meet, it is not just a health disaster, but it's an employment disaster and it's an economic development disaster for that community. So that triple whammy is a real problem, and we've got to figure out how to deal with that, because the cost of health care right now, it's cost us too much. And importantly, we're not getting what we're paying for. You know, we pay 2 to 3 times what other industrialized nations pay for their health systems, and we don't get the same kind of quality results that they get.
Right. Thank you so much for being with us. Please join us again sometime. It was a really good hour, and I appreciate your expertise in so many areas. Thank you, Dr. Benjamin.
Kathleen, thank you.
Our guest this hour, Dr. Georges Benjamin, Executive Director of the American Public Health Association, which has been around for a long time, since 1872, and he is well known in the world of public health as a practitioner and administrator, has been the executive director for a number of years, which has been around for, as I said, a long, long time. And he came to this post from his position as secretary of the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. We thank him for his time. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in the Royce Federal Plaza, our new home. And thanks for all your calls, everybody. News is coming up. We'll be back with another hour of conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn, a minute before 10 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.